Hello, and welcome to the Conference for Women teleclass, Get More Money. Joining us today is personal finance and career journalist Kristen Wong. You may have read her in the New York Times, New York Magazine, or Life Hacker, among other publications. Kristen's latest book is called Get Money, Live the Life You Want, Not Just the Life You Can Afford. And today, she's going to share some advice on negotiating your way to a higher net worth. Kristen, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, everyone, and thank you for being a part of this teleclass. I am very excited to share with you my negotiation story and some things that I think you can learn from my experience as someone who has used negotiating to level up her salary and as a journalist who's reported on this topic over the years. So I'll start with some theoretical advice, then get into some really actionable and practical strategies that you can use now. A bit about me, I am a full-time journalist and freelance writer, and being a writer, I feel like if I can successfully negotiate, then there might be hope for other people too. As a writer, I've always had this idea that I should be lucky to get any work that came my way, any job that came my way. So one of my first writing gigs was writing for an art magazine that paid me a whopping 8 cents a word, which came out to about $35 for an article that would take me a couple of days to write. I never even thought about negotiating with this client. I figured I was lucky to get this job, and even just wanting more money meant that I was being greedy or ungrateful for it. So this way of thinking went on for a couple of years. I would always take these low-paying or no-paying writing jobs, and even in my quote-unquote survival job, my 9-to-5 job as a technical writer, that mindset carried over, and I didn't negotiate in that job either. The men in my family would always tell me to value my work and ask for more, and my reply was always, you don't understand, I'm a writer, we're not supposed to make that much money. I really believed there was no possible way to ask for more, and I thought the very idea of negotiating in my industry was kind of ridiculous. Then I read something from a negotiating expert named Barbara Stanny, who described 9 traits of what she calls under-earners. Under-earners are people who earn less than they potentially could, and every single trait seemed to resonate with me. It was like she was describing me. So I'm going to tell you some of these traits, and you can see if any of them resonate with you too. So under-earners have a high tolerance for low pay. Stanny writes that high earners make darn sure they're well compensated for their time and work, but it rarely dawns on or appeals to an under-earner to set her sights on a higher salary. I was so guilty of this. It never even crossed my mind. It didn't cross my mind half the time to ask for more money. Other traits, under-earners are willing to work for free, also me. Under-earners believe in the nobility of poverty. That is, we sort of romanticize being broke as if we're martyrs and everyone else who makes money is a sellout. And of course, under-earners are lousy negotiators. All of these traits described me to a T. In or outside of the workplace, this was all true. I always hated asking for more, and I had a hard time speaking up in general. I was kind of the opposite of assertive. So after reading about these traits, which hit a little too close to home for me, I decided to try an experiment. I decided to ask all of my existing writing clients for a little bit more money, and any new client that came my way, I vowed to ask for a slightly higher rate. So as a ballpark, I aimed to ask for 20% more because I had read an article from Clark University that said most employers can afford to pay you 20% more than they initially offer. Now, you should negotiate based on research, and we will get to that in a bit, but 20% seems like a good round number to shoot for. It wasn't too much to scare someone off, but it was enough to make a difference in my own salary. So if nothing else in this experiment, I just wanted to prove that negotiating is BS. I wanted to prove that it doesn't work for everyone and writers really do make next to nothing. But the outcome of my experiment surprised me. Every single client that I approached for more money said yes. And I simply asked them something like, "Hi, Ellen, I've been writing for you for about 6 months now, and I think my writing really resonates with your readers and helps bring in a decent amount of blog traffic every month. Would you consider a rate increase from 16 cents a word to 25 cents a word?" It was a very simple formula. I made the case for the value I brought, and then I asked for more. This particular editor's response was, "Of course we can do that, Kristen." So not only was that a yes, but it was an emphatic yes. So this was an eye-opening and life-changing experiment. In a few years, I went from making 8 cents a word, 16 cents a word, $50 an article, to earning $300 an article, then a dollar per word, then over $1,000 an article. I was earning nearly 6 figures just from my freelance writing, which was something I thought was completely unheard of. I thought that was absurd when I was just starting out. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons that my income leveled up in that way. I mean, I learned to be a better writer. I found bigger clients, of course. But it certainly would not have happened if I didn't learn to get over my fear and ask for more money. The lesson here for everyone else is negotiating is for everyone. And there are some added benefits beyond just making more money. When you negotiate, even if you negotiate, you know, benefits or paid time off, you send a message. You tell the other party that you value your work and you're strong enough to speak up for yourself. It conveys confidence in not just yourself, but the things you do and the work that you do. So in turn, this makes your employer confident in you, and it also tells them you're not a pushover. There's a thing that happens with freelancers a lot called scope creep, where you think you're getting into a gig and you're doing one job, and then it suddenly turns into 5 different jobs, and I think negotiating kind of helps keep that at bay. But I think a lot of us are really afraid to negotiate. And why is that? Well, for one, I think women especially tend to have that "I'm just lucky to be here" attitude. Because of the way we're socialized, because of the way perhaps we're treated in the workplace, we tend to feel more like imposters in our jobs, and we tend to feel almost undeserving of the work we have. I always felt like if I negotiated or spoke up for myself or stood my ground in any way, that it meant I was ungrateful for the job I had. It took me a long time to learn that you can be grateful for what you have and still strive for more. So I think that's one fear you have to let go of. Stop thinking of speaking up as being greedy or selfish. And one way to get over this is to remind yourself that in speaking up and negotiating, you're making it more common for other women to do this. There's research that shows women have an easier time negotiating when we think our negotiating is going to help the people around us. As women, again, we are socialized to value equality and community, and that's not a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with that. So if you have trouble negotiating, remember, you're not just doing this for yourself. You're doing this for other women and other people in your industry. And that's actually what helped me as a writer, was other writers telling me to stop accepting low rates because I was lowering the bar for writers everywhere. And similarly, in shooting for higher rates, I hope that I'm raising the bar for writers and, you know, maybe even women to be paid more. But in order to do that, you have to ask. No one is just going to give the money to you, of course. So the second fear that keeps us from negotiating is rejection. And along those lines, I want to tell you one of my favorite negotiating stories. So during this experiment, I had gotten an email from my biggest client at that time, which was NBC News. They wanted me to write news stories for their website, and they threw out a rate that I actually thought was pretty fair. But I was on this negotiating kick, and I promised myself to ask any and all clients for more money. But NBC News, I really didn't want to lose that gig. And negotiating experts, they always like to say, you should always ask because the worst someone can say is no. And I've always thought, well, that's not true. The worst someone can say is no, and how dare you ask us for more money? We never want to work with you again. So I wasn't just afraid of no. I was afraid of complete, flat-out rejection. But I had made a promise to myself, and I forced myself to ask NBC News, the biggest and best client I had ever communicated with at that time, I decided to ask them for more money. And guess what they said? Nope. It was the first time I had ever gotten a no in my negotiating experiment. And I always thought, you know, the sky was going to fall, the world would end, I would never work in this town again. But none of that happened. They simply apologized. They said maybe we could revisit that rate later. We never did. But I continued to work with them for a year, and everything was fine. But actually, it was more than fine, because getting that no helped inoculate me. I knew now what rejection actually looked like, and I could see that it really wasn't that bad. And more importantly than that, I now have the satisfaction of knowing that I had successfully pushed the boundaries of my earning potential. I was no longer an under-earner. I had negotiated, I had valued my work, and, you know, I got a no, but at least no one could say I was an under-earner. Once I got over my fear of no and learned to start speaking up, Then I started researching, reporting on, and trying some of my own negotiation strategies. Now, I do want to throw one caveat out there. I'm sort of wary of the advice that tells women to always negotiate and always speak up, because there is research that shows women pay a social penalty when they negotiate. And the research basically says that when men negotiate, they're viewed as powerful and assertive, whereas when women negotiate, we are viewed as unlikable. This social penalty could have implications on how you do your job. Of course, I'm not saying that you shouldn't negotiate because of the social penalty. It's my opinion that for me, I negotiate because of the social penalty and because I want to make it more normal for women like me to ask and to speak up. But I do think it's just something that you have to be aware of, and I do think you have to use discretion when you're negotiating. I'm also hesitant of the advice to always ask, because you really should do your research, and that's kind of negotiating 101. Make sure you know what your position, your job, your skills, your experience, everything you bring to the table, make sure you know what the monetary value of that is. What are other people being paid who have your same background? And, you know, you can use websites like Glassdoor.com to research what people in your position are generally paid, because you don't want to go into a negotiation blindly just asking for more money. You want to be able to quantify it and back it up with numbers. So research what your job commands and quantify the value that you bring. That might mean you developed a workshop that's now being used by 10 other branches. That might mean you brought $10,000 in sales to the company in 1 month. Learn how success is measured in your job and then quantify your success in that role. And also make sure you research what the goals of the company are and how you're adding value to those goals. And that's kind of the next bit of advice I have for negotiating, is focus on what the other party is getting out of it. If you focus on what the other party is getting out of the deal, this accomplishes a few things. Number one, the other party is less likely to be on the defense when you ask for more, because they're seeing that you're interested in what's in it for them. So they're now thinking more about what they're getting and less about what they're giving up. Second, it helps you not view the negotiation as a confrontation, but as a mutually beneficial agreement. If you are not naturally an assertive person, it's so much easier to negotiate when you stop thinking of it as a confrontation. And third, when you focus on what the other party values, it just shows that you care. It shows you're not just in this for more money, even though maybe you are, but it shows that you actually care about the company's goals. So focus on and quantify the value you bring to the table. One specific concept you want to be aware of when you're negotiating is anchoring. Anchoring is a psychological phenomenon in which you rely too heavily on one piece of information to make subsequent decisions about something. So advertisers use this all the time. And a good example of this is like a restaurant menu. So on a restaurant menu, you see a featured item, right? It's highlighted in a big box and bold font. It's impossible to miss. And let's say that featured item is a $20 cheeseburger, and you think, oh my God, who would pay $20 for a cheeseburger? That's ridiculous. So then you start looking through the rest of the menu, and you see a $15 cheeseburger, and suddenly that seems reasonable to you. You would never otherwise buy a $15 cheeseburger, but that $20 featured item served as an anchor. Maybe the restaurant never even expected you to buy the $20 cheeseburger. It was a distraction. It was a way to make you think the other prices are reasonable compared to the anchor, and salary negotiation can work the same way. For example, let's say you go into a job interview and expect that your starting salary at this job is going to be $55,000 a year. You've done your research, you know your value, and that is the price tag you put on this job. It's the number that you plan to ask for. But then, at the end of the interview, the interviewer throws out a completely different number that catches you off guard. They say the starting salary is $45,000 a year. That's a lot less than the $55,000 you were expecting, so when they ask if that sounds reasonable to you, instead of asking for your original number, that 55, you lower and counter it with 50, because 50 now seems more reasonable since they've given you a low anchor. So this is why research is important, because when you make the case for the 55,000, you want to be able to back that up and focus on the facts and not just this random anchor. So the first tip when it comes to anchoring is kind of a defensive one. You just want to be aware of it and make sure you're not falling for it. Another thing to be aware of is that many employers are actually banned from asking you how much you earned in your previous job. And it's because of anchoring. Some regions and some states in the U.S. have outlawed this question because the idea is that it might put people, especially women, at a disadvantage. If you are underpaid in your previous job, then that low salary serves as a false and kind of unfair anchor. So if you weren't making that much, how are you ever supposed to move up if you have this low anchor to work with? So before you go into a job interview, make sure that you know your rights. If they do ask you what you were making in your old job and they are allowed to ask that, try to refocus the conversation on the salary that you're hoping for. So if they say, how much were you making in your last job? You might say, well, I'm looking to move on from that position and the salary that I'm looking for is $55,000 a year. If they keep pressing and they're not going to take no for an answer, you should definitely be honest and you can tell them something like, I'm currently looking to earn $55,000. I was only making $40,000 in my old job and I found out that I was significantly, that was significantly lower than the amount my skills and experience can command. So aside from these defensive tactics, you can also use anchoring in your favor. And this is kind of a silly example, but there was this very interesting study that came out a few years ago that found even just joking about a ridiculously high salary can get you a better offer. So in the study, when asked about starting salaries, participants would say something in the negotiation like, well, of course I would love a salary of $100,000 a year, but I'm really just looking for what's fair. I think a reasonable amount would be $35,000. They would say something like that. So in this study, just joking about that $100,000 served as an effective anchor so that the group who made the joke about a super higher starting salary were offered better deals than the people who just straight up said what they wanted to make. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you, you know, you need to joke with your potential new employer. I'd be very careful about that. But this just goes to show you how effective anchoring can be. So if you have to throw out the first number, that's not always a bad thing. If you're not sure what your salary can be, it might make sense to err on the higher side of what you have in mind, just so you have that higher anchor. Another tip is to use specific numbers. So instead of a round number like 50,000, you might say you want a starting salary of 52,000. This sounds less like an arbitrary amount that you just pulled out of the air, and it actually gives the impression that you've done your research and you have reasons for arriving at a more exact figure. Another study from Columbia University found that anchoring comes in handy when you have to give a salary range. The other party is more likely to meet you closer to the top of your range. So for example, if you want a range between $40,000 and $55,000 a year, the other party is more likely to try to err on the $55,000 a year rather than the $40,000. I actually interviewed the lead researcher on this study, Malia Mason, and she said this is due to hidden politeness concerns. The other party basically feels like it's impolite to offer something on the lower side of your salary, so they actually use the higher number as the anchor. So if you say your desired salary range is between 40 and 55, the research shows they're more likely to stay above 40 rather than below, if that makes sense. So this is just something to keep in mind if you have to throw out the first number in a negotiation. Now, Malia Mason is one of the leading researchers on negotiation. So while I had her on the phone, I had to ask her what her best negotiation tip was. She told me counteroffers. Counteroffers make it so much easier to negotiate because you have leverage. When there's another offer on the table, it serves as a valuable anchor because it's realistic and it's relevant. The numbers are right there. She said that if you are looking for a job, you should not be talking to one person ever. Always talk to two people because having a strong alternative to the person you're talking to is a complete game changer. So that's anchoring in a nutshell. Now I want to share with you a very specific strategy that I talk about in my book for asking for a raise with the current job, current client, current employer. I use this myself and I call it the feedback strategy. With the feedback strategy, you basically ask your employer or client for feedback regarding your job, then you implement that feedback and then you ask for more money. So here's what it looks like. A couple of months or say 6 weeks or something before you plan to ask for a raise, send an email to your boss or sit down with them and ask to have a meeting and tell them something like, hey, when you have a moment, I'm hoping you can offer feedback about my job performance. Is there anything specific you'd like to see me work on? Personally, I've been trying to do X, and then X is whatever skill or habit you think you could improve. What do you think? Am I on the right track? I would greatly appreciate any insight or feedback you might have for me. So when you send this email, it shows that you are genuinely open to criticism, and it tells your boss that you want to do your job better. It also shows that you value their opinion and you respect his or her position. And finally, it tells them you're confident enough to take control in your job and position yourself for a raise. So they might even see the request coming, but when you approach it in this way, again, you're focusing on the value that's in it for them instead of just asking for more money. So step two of the feedback strategy is to actually implement that feedback. You don't necessarily, you know, want to ask for feedback and then ask for a raise the very next day, right? I mean, if your boss says something like, oh, nothing, you've been doing a perfect job, then you might want to consider doing that. But depending on the feedback you actually get, I would give yourself a month or two before you ask for a significant pay increase. That way you have time to process what they're asking you to do and then put it into practice. So step three of the feedback strategy is to negotiate your raise. After you put your employer's suggestions into practice and you've made some progress, that should help give you some confidence to make the ask. And you'll either write them an email or you'll schedule a meeting with your boss and tell them you've appreciated their feedback and you've considered it, you've implemented it successfully. And again, you can provide a few concrete, quantifiable examples of how you've done this. Tell them that you believe your skills are valuable and you would like to request a raise, and then throw out your number. This makes it so much easier for them to give you what you want because you've already given them what they want. It's a lot more effective than just straight up asking your boss for more money. Not only have you focused on the value that you're bringing to the table, but you've gotten them to focus on it too. So everybody wins. And I think that's just a great way to look at negotiation overall. Negotiating is not a confrontation. It is mutually beneficial. When you speak up and ask for more, you're not being greedy or ungrateful or difficult. You simply want to make sure you're being fairly compensated for the value you bring to the table. And finally, negotiation is about more than money. It's about learning to beat imposter syndrome, learning to value your work and feel confident in your role. At the end of the day, it's about getting comfortable with advocating for yourself. So I hope this helps kickstart your own negotiation experiments, and I hope you're successful with it. Thank you.
Great. Some really helpful tips and tricks in there. As a reminder to everyone, we will be posting a recording of this teleclass online, so you can look it up and listen again before your next salary negotiation. Now, Kristen, your work spans both money making and money management. So while we have you here, I wanted to pose a few personal finance questions that some of our listeners may have.
Sure.
First, you've shared some of the ways women are unique when it comes to negotiation. So putting on your personal finance hat, are there specific things that you wish more women would know or do when it comes to managing their money?
I don't know. There are conflicting studies about, you know, how women handle money when it comes to investing and concepts like that. But I think also just generally the financial services industry, a lot of it is they have very outdated stereotypes that they work with when they deal with women. I know this from my own firsthand experience trying to take out a mortgage with my husband, and they just constantly would just only talk to my husband. And I think women have to be aware of this. I think it's important because it is, you know, money is not the most exciting topic. And it's very easy when somebody wants to default to your husband to allow them to do so. Like what I said, when I was, you know, taking out a mortgage to buy our house, they would just constantly go to Brian, my husband, and just explain everything to him. You know, I didn't really need to know about it as far as they were concerned. They would always reach out to him. And it would have been very easy to just let him do all the work. I think it's important to not let that happen and to make sure that you are a part of the conversation too. And you are, you know, you're learning about how your finances work too. I actually have a friend who's a wealth manager, and she was saying, you know, at a lot of firms, what happens is when the husband passes away and the wife is widowed, she has no idea how the finances work. She doesn't know where the money even is. And so I had read, you know, this fidelity study about that. And I was telling my wealth manager friend about this. And she was like, yeah, and you know what happens is as soon as the husband passes away, the wife usually will find a new financial advisor, one that's willing to talk to her. So I feel like it's in the best interest of these financial services companies to, you know, appeal to women and stop making it seem like we are a niche in the market. But I think as a woman, it's just something that you have to be very aware of is like, make sure that that, you know, you're open to learning about how the finances work and not just let your husband be the default person to take care of it, because it's very easy to do that. And a lot of these companies try, you know, make it very easy to do that.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure everyone listening has had that experience of being looked past when it comes to talking money.
It's very frustrating.
So, for the listeners who are, well, let me change gears. Let's talk about retirement. For the listeners who are sort of just starting out in their careers, and we have a huge diversity of ages and everything on the call. How do you recommend tackling that 401k allocation kind of right off the bat? I know the easy thing to do is to put it in all in a target date fund. Is that a good idea?
I mean, I think it's a good idea. Target date funds are a good idea to help you just get started. And 401ks are a good idea to help you just get started, because when you have that option there, it makes it so easy. And I think a lot of times people are so overwhelmed with investing that they don't know where to go. They don't know where to begin. And a target date fund and a 401k certainly makes it really easy to just like tick a box and you're an investor, right? But there's a lot of criticism about target date funds and 401ks. And the criticism is that, you know, they're not the best investments and the fees are kind of higher than you would get, say, with like a regular index fund or, you know, opening an IRA, an individual retirement account on your own. You know, if you open an individual retirement account, that gives you more freedom and flexibility to kind of pick your own investments that are often cheaper. But I think, you know, let's point out that if you have an employer 401k match, you definitely want to take advantage of that, because it's basically, you know, as a lot of people will say, it's basically like free money. It's like your employer is giving you money to save, right? So you want to take full advantage of that. But like, if you're up for it, I would say, after that, after you've maxed out your employer match, then sure, look into opening an individual retirement account and picking your own index funds. And I mean, that's a whole other teleclass, but that's where I would start in the research. Target date funds, I mean, they're fine, but you know, personally, I mean, I have invested in target date funds before, and then I kind of changed my investments when I started learning a little bit more about how investing works. And index funds and exchange-traded funds were like the place I started with my research.
Right. Okay, so then for those of us who want our hands really held, how would you recommend finding good financial advice, you know, a good advisor?
First of all, I think you want to make sure that they're a certified financial planner. That basically, when they're a CFP, that means they take a fiduciary oath to act in your best interest and not just kind of sell you financial products, right? And I think the CFP, you can go to like the website and you can look up advisors that way. But, you know, I mean, asking for recommendations is always good, but you want to make sure, you know, if nothing else, they are CFP with the little registered trademark behind their name. Make sure they're a fee-only advisor is typically better, because they charge a flat fee or an hourly fee for the time they spend managing your finances. And they're not going to like take a commission if you go with if they're trying to sell you a specific financial product, I would be a little bit wary of that, because, you know, they might be getting kickbacks or something like that. But CFPs are not supposed to do that. So, you know, I would go there. I would start with, you know, just looking for somebody who has the registered CFP and has taken a fiduciary oath. And you could even straight up just ask them, do you accept fiduciary responsibility? When you interview a CFP, you should always interview them before you decide to go with them. You know, other questions you want to ask are, exactly what services do you perform? And it can be, you know, do they do retirement planning? Do they do tax planning? Do they do long-term care? So you want to know exactly like what their area of expertise is. And, you know, you might ask them what kind of investments would they want to put you in, you know? So I would just kind of ask them what their plan is would be for your finances, and just kind of have a pre-interview, like you're interviewing them for the job, basically.
Cool. Okay, well, that's all we can squeeze into 30 minutes. So Kristen's book, again, is Get Money, and you can find her online at thewildwong.com. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.